It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 337 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I have a special interview, and that's with Gene Haw, the creator of May, M-A-E. You'll hear that several times. I want to make sure people get that name spelled right. It's a story about strong females, and I love strong female character stories, as you well know. You can get the first six issues in a trade right now. And you can also pick up number 7, which is the first in the second volume, and it's available as well. It's really a wonderful story, but I'll let him describe it. He's actually doing the writing and the art in this. He's well known for his artwork, but maybe not so much his writing, but I think this book will change all that. It's about a girl and her sister that are reunited, and they have to take on forces that are going to challenge them, which, of course, is a story I'm going to love, and I hope you will, too. We talk about how the book came to be, as well as what the future holds for this wonderful character and her story. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Gene Haw, the artist of many good things in comics, including May right now, which he has come together and been making. So we'll get to the other stuff later. How you doing, Gene?
I'm doing good.
Good. Now, my understanding is you started off on Green Lantern a while back, and then you moved up into different Marvel things with the adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix and Cable. Did Superman, and the 49ers, of course, is probably what I think you're best known for.
Yeah.
Which is great.
I also had a fun stretch working with James Robinson on Starman projects, which is, also it's important. The editor on that was Archie Goodwin and his assistant Chuck Kim. And Archie Goodwin is one of the kind of almost forgotten legends of comics. He had a huge influence on making some of the best stuff happen at DC.
Wow, that's good for you. That's quite a pedigree there.
Oh, yeah.
You've done quite a lot. So, okay, all that good stuff is really great. But talk about creating May. And my understanding is you basically put the whole thing together except for a couple parts. Talk about what you do and what other people do for you.
Let's see. May is a book that I write. I draw it. On the first two issues worth, I did all of the coloring except for I had some color assistance from Rose McLean. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it's now Wesley Hartman, also known as Westflow, is doing the coloring, and then I just do a little bit of touch-up to make it match my style.
Wow. Okay. So basically, it's your book. I mean, you know, granted, these other people do provide a lot of support, but you do a lot of the stuff. When it comes to story and art and stuff, that's usually the lion's share of a book.
Let me see. Other people do great things that I can't do quickly and well. So, I think I'm a pretty good colorist, but I cannot do that quickly. And so Wesley does that. And then there's also Xander Cannon, who does lettering. And his style is you can tell he does it by hand. I do not like digital lettering, or I prefer against digital lettering, given the option. Because it's always a little bit too precise and too perfect. Mm-hmm. And with my art my art sometimes gets mistaken for computer graphics, where people assume I use a 3D model for the characters and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I want to give it, I like to get the energy that Xander gives it by just doing all the lettering by hand.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, it's interesting because, you know, I was reading on Wikipedia, which we know is always right, and it was saying on there that you do an Alex Ross kind of thing, where sometimes you take pictures of people and put yourself in there, and then you draw some of the stuff based on what that looks like. Is that true?
I used to do that a lot more. Frankly, what it is that when I lived inside of a small town in Indiana, and hold on a second. I just got an alert reminding me, hey, you've got an audio podcast interview right now. Anyway, let me see. But anyway, when I lived in when I got out of college in Detroit, and I had all my college classmates around me, and when I was living in a small town in Bloomington, Indiana, mm-hmm. I used a lot of reference models because everyone lived close by me that I knew. Mm-hmm. Once I moved to place like started moving to place like Minneapolis, and then especially to the Chicago area, mm-hmm. My friends are 40 minutes away and 2 hours away with traffic sometimes. So I use a lot less photo reference now.
Hmm. It's interesting. I don't see a difference, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, maybe you did it that so long that it got you used to doing that style of art, and now I don't see any kind of photo reference involved in it.
I have a backstock if I need to do an unusual angle or something like that. I can just find an old photo I took of a friend doing whatever. Sometimes my wife will occasionally model, but that's frankly only a handful of times per year. I have a mirror next to my table, like every realistic artist should. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing you'll see as a difference is that things like hand poses. I tend to hold my hands in certain ways, and if I use my own hands for reference, it'll tend to look like how I use my hands. Mm-hmm. If I use someone else's hands for figure reference, the body language of hands is where you see the biggest difference.
Hmm. Isn't that interesting? Because I'm always, you know, I always remember when Steve Ditko, one time in the middle of a Spider-Man thing, he put a picture, which was obviously himself in an art gallery looking at a picture of a foot, and he was saying how he wished he could draw feet like that. And I always get a kick out of that because, you know, his feet, like Gil Kane's hand, they were always kind of really, it looked like they were broken somehow and they had gotten reset in a different position. So I always get a kick out of that. But, you know, it's your art style, it's your book. So you get to do what you want, especially since you're doing all the stuff in it. So, you know, hey, it works out well for me.
I find it fascinating looking at other people's drawings because you can see a lot of how they the kind of like almost like a 3D computer model of a human body that they have inside their head. Mm-hmm. And then you get the scary thing where sometimes it turns out they don't actually have a 3D model of the human body inside their head. Mm-hmm. It's actually a 2D model. And then you'll see, the famous Brokeback poses where you'll see a female figure at a weird angle. Mm-hmm. But no matter what angle the rib cage is at, the breasts are pointing straight at you. And each one's a perfect sphere. It's like Mickey Mouse's ears.
How does he do that?
It's just, you know, they want to get that butt, like the butt kind of visible, and they want to have the breast pointing at you, and then the body's twisting off at some weird 45-degree angle away from you, mm-hmm. like a sundial, you know, like a sundial, whatever the triangle thing is. Mm-hmm. But well, the breasts are going to be looking at you. Well, you know, it's like the eyes that follow you across the room in a portrait.
But you know, the whole notion of comics was that the young teen boys were buying these books. And, of course, they always say that, you know, many females have two outstanding characteristics. And those are the two, apparently. And those are very important for young teenage boys to be able to get it to read right. So, I never was much of that. I'm a leg guy myself, I guess. And so, to me, I'm much more interested in that. Although, I do have to say, like, George Perez and Starfire used to just... I thought they were going to fly off the page at me there for a while. It was really something the way he does it. But.
Oh, man. Well, the nice thing about George Perez is he gave all of Starfire so much personality. Mm-hmm. No one really minded it that much. It's not like, it was not like her breasts were following your eyes across the page or something. You know, man, what's weird. They tended to be about in the right place.
Well, that's good. That's good. Yeah, I wish he would be able to draw more, but, you know, it's hard after this time. You know, he's been doing it for so long and, you know, so well that, you know, we just have to treasure what we have, I think.
Oh, yeah. I got to sit next to him when he was sitting in a plaza in Spain, mm-hmm. Just drawing for anyone who came by.
Wow.
And he's a guy, one of those guys who can visualize a whole page mm-hmm. before he starts penciling it. Mm-hmm. And then essentially he's just... at least at the time, he was able to just trace it onto the paper.
Wow. See, that's amazing to me. I mean, you know, I asked him one time because he had these things that had these, like, sparkles coming off of a thing of Batman, and I was going, like, how do you see that? So, I don't know, it just comes to my head, and that's what I draw. Yeah. I was like, wow, see, that's the difference in you and me. I would never think of that in a million years, and I couldn't try to make that happen. And it's a lot has to do with like with your artwork too. You have a very realistic painterly kind of style, which I really enjoy. I've always enjoyed that kind of look to it. Yeah. That make the characters breathe for me in many ways. And honestly, your characterization is really strong too. I was going to ask you, is May the first book that you've done both the writing and the art on?
I did a 12-page short story in, I think it was in 2003. It was a Iron Fist story for Marvel Double Shots number 4. Mm. It was part of the Marvel Knights sub-brand, whatever you call it, label, mm-hmm. sub-brand. And I had a writer, I don't want to name him because he's a great guy, but he wasn't able to do the story. Mm. And then the editor told me there's only one guy left on the project who's able to write this 12-page story, and that's you, because you're the guy. So I had he assigned me to write my first story, and I had to go, through 5 drafts. And Stuart Moore just had to keep on pointing out more and problems as we went along and teaching me, here's why this is a problem, here's how you fix it. This you're not thinking through why the villain is doing stuff. Mm-hmm. You have the hero saying this, and Iron Fist is a legendarily philosophical and moral character. Is that what he'd really say in this situation? Think it through, Gene. And I owe him so much for teaching me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 3 great teachers in my career. Stuart Moore, Xander Cannon, who, because he'd come up indie and had done writing, art, lettering, coloring, graphic design, dealing with printers. He was able to explain so much to me. And the other one is, I mentioned him earlier, Archie Goodwin.
Oh, wow. Well, those are, again, that's a nice pedigree to have, those good folks, because they're pretty strong, especially when it comes to storytelling. They're really good storytellers.
Oh, yeah.
So that's great.
I'd say they're all geniuses. And geniuses are stuff that I still can't do.
Well, I have to tell you, May is a great book. Now, let's talk a little bit about how we got to where we are. Because my understanding is the first 6 issues I got them, so that's right. I got the trade from you I can't remember which convention. I've seen you at several cons, which is always great. I'm always glad to see you at conventions, because I think that's one great way to interact with fans, is to get out and mingle with the folks, and they give you feedback. Yeah. Which is always good. And I saw you one, and I bought the trade there. And then now, I think it's just this past week or two that this is where I got a question, though. Is it number 7, or is it volume 2, number 1? I've seen it referred to in 2 different ways.
Oh, man. We kind of switched back and forth a few times in discussing it at Lionforge. Actually, on the cover of number 7, it says boldly, number 7. And then I think in smaller print, it says volume 2, number 1.
Okay. So you want the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
That's a good way to do it.
Yeah, confuse everybody.
That's right. Because, I understand that number 1s sell better than number 7s.
Yeah.
I get that. But on the other hand, I would much rather read a good story that goes over, say, 12 issues or 24 issues, something like that, than constantly having number 1s and trying to keep track of it. So I'm glad you're doing what you're doing, because I think that's a good way. Make number 7 more prominent so people know which book this is. And then kind of for those people who are interested in having volume 2, number 1, it's in there too.
Yeah. And I don't want to become one of those people who writes an issue of a comic without thinking of the chapter breaks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I hate those issues where it just feels like, oh, this whole issue is just set up for the next issue. If you're going to release things inside of a monthly format, write for the monthly format. But I also want to keep a strong eye on the graphic novel collections so that each one kind of has satisfying beats and turns and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's just making it all work together.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to mention to you something, and I don't know if you know this or not, but I was looking up trying to find out how to pronounce May.
Yeah.
And I ended up in the Urban Dictionary.
Huh.
And May means something, M-A-E, and I'll read it to you and see what you think of this. Mays are outgoing and always being cheerful and happy. They make the they make the best friends and keep them. They're also charismatic. They're friendly and smiling, and also a bit insecure, but don't show it. Mays are really pretty and flirt without you knowing it. They don't care what other people's opinions about them are. They're loyal and honest, sometimes a bit klutzy, and are hilarious, great sense of humor. Also, usually athletes, very good ones. And I was like, on some levels, that really describes your character in the book.
that is really weird.
I mean, I just dumped on it. I'm like, that's funny. I said, my gosh, that sounds just almost like the character. You know, there's a couple differences between them. But as far as that goes, when I sat there and read that, I said, I wondered if you knew that when you put the character together, or was this just one of those great circumstances that happens in life when you stumble across something, you make something great, and talk about geniuses being on the same page and stuff like that. I was stunned when I read that.
That was totally random to me. I had no idea.
I was very surprised when I read that. So I just, I just thought that was a wonderful thing. And I never knew that that's what a May is. And so, you might want to put that up there and say, hey, the May is an Urban Dictionary is out there and describes my character pretty well.
Oh, man.
I really like that. So I was really moved by that. Why don't you tell people, because I read the first six issues, really loved them. I read the first issue of the next run, which I really loved, number seven. And I am always surprised by the things that you do. And you and I have talked about this, about female characters in comics. And when I've seen you at conventions, I've asked you about it and kind of stuff, about how, many times comics have male leads. This is a case where you have a female lead, and there are a lot of the people around her are female as well. And so for somebody like me, a guy who has read comics for so long and mostly read men characters, it's nice to read this kind of stuff. It's kind of a relief and kind of a fun thing to read, May and the characters around her. Talk about that. Was that intentional, or did you just happen to like the character or the way it developed in your mind? How'd that come to be?
Oh, there's a few things here. One is, of course, I've talked about this before. May started off as fan fiction of Kyle. I am the worst person in the world. I can't remember his last name right now. Why I Hate Saturn.
Baker?
Kyle Baker, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I'm the worst person for names. remembering names. Kyle Baker's Why I Hate Saturn, which was about two bickering sisters. And one of them is probably insane because she claims that she's been spending time on Saturn, leading the Leather and Saturn girls. And she shows up in a weird spacesuit. And I began playing around with these ideas and switching the characters a bit, and enough so that I have told Kyle Baker about this, and he's amused by what I've done. And he doesn't have a problem with it. But partially it was that, and I just liked how the sisters fought each other, and it's different than how brothers do, because I've only had brothers growing up, and if things ever got tense enough, eventually we wrestled or punched each other, and then things were settled for a while. That usually doesn't happen with sisters, and usually it's just this amazing cutting each other down, making fun of each other. And just the way Kyle wrote that was brilliant and showed me there's this whole world of social interactions I didn't even know existed. another thing is that it's also – May is very much based on a whole class of my friends, both people around my age, a lot younger, in the 30s, 20s, and the daughters of friends and stuff like that, and kind of the world of almost nieces inside my world, and just geeky girls who are doing amazing things because they're geeks. My godchild is one of them. Visually, May is based on the daughter of a high school friend of mine. And there's not – these characters – there's female geeks don't show up in fiction as the hero very often, especially not until recently. Classically, either they're the person coming in over the hero's headset saying, "You need to turn left here. Now go up to the safe and punch these numbers in." Or the other classic thing is, of course, the geek girl shows up if she is the hero, and then a guy takes off her glasses, lets down her hair, and says, "Oh my God, you're not a geek. You're beautiful." And then the girl says, "Oh, thank God I'm not a geek. Oh, I'll never have to be a geek again." And I wanted May to be a hero because she's a geek. I'm assuming as a geek, I'm assuming you're a pretty geeky guy and you know a lot of geeky girls.
The interesting thing is, until recently, I didn't know many geeky girls. When I grew up, there were no girls that I knew who were into this stuff. It was a guy thing to read comics and stuff like that. I got to college, same thing. And then it wasn't until not long ago I joined like a Star Trek club, and there were a bunch of girls as well as guys in there. And we started to – it was interesting to watch them react. That's one of the things I love about the book, is you're kind of filling in that gap for me that I don't understand all that well, are female geeks and how they interact and what goes on with them. So it's one thing I really enjoy about the book is that you've taken that aspect and filled that in for me and given me some more information about that.
Okay. I feel like at this moment I am your Kyle Baker, and I'm very curious what you're going to turn this into as fan fiction in 5, 10, or 15 years.
Well, I have to say that the characters are great, but one thing we probably should do before we get too far into it is to describe what the book's about. Give us the basic premise about that.
Okay, so May is about two sisters who live in rural Indiana, and 8 years before the story starts, the older sister, Abby, disappears without a trace. She doesn't leave. There's no note. No one knows what happened. So for all this time until the story begins, May has been taking care of their aging dad, worrying where her sister disappeared to. And the story starts a little bit after she gets out of high school, and she gets a call from the sheriff's office saying, "We found your sister, and she's drunk. You need to pick her up." So she heads down. Her sister's there, wearing a crazy costume, and says she's fine. She's been on another world fighting against mad scientists and monsters and leading barbarian warrior cats into battle, which is too much for May to believe up until the monsters start following her back. And at that point, things start blowing up, and May ends up joining her sister on the other world to try to track down what happened to their dad and rescue him. And chaos goes from there as May learns that she cannot trust her sister to think things through, and May realizes she's going to have to take responsibility for what happens inside of her own life.
Very good. I really enjoy the interaction between them. Now, are they both geek girls in that sense?
They're kind of different classes of geek girls. Abby's kind of like an action movie sci-fi geek to some extent.
Okay.
She loves Harry Potter for the violence and the drama and stuff like that, but she doesn't like – not so much for like the fantastical ideas. She loves Star Wars and video games. But May is she loves ideas. She loves action. She loves character. She loves science, and she's a computer technician. She just loves playing with new ideas and thinking things through. And she has patience. A pretty good way to kind of describe the two characters is that Abby is literally an action hero. She thinks like an action hero. She thinks everything is about herself. And the solution to anything, just like in most comics, is just punching something harder.
And May, of course, doesn't look at that way.
No, and she can't, because if she gets punched by a troll and goes flying 20 feet, just like us, she will end up either in the emergency room or dead.
Wow. It's pretty cool. Because, you know, it, on those levels, it's fun to see. Because, you know, like I said, I don't know many girls on either fandom, to be honest with you. And so for me, to watch them is a real experience for me. And I'm kind of glad you're getting to do it, because I've always felt like I didn't understand all this. And I'm starting to grasp it a little more. Every issue that I read, I get, okay, that's why she's doing this. And that's why that's happening. And I think it's a great thing. It's very much of a fantasy adventure. Yeah. Great fun. Lots of adventure to it.
Oh, yeah. I call it I've been informed by Bill Willingham. So it's obviously a modern fantasy story. But Bill Willingham told me that the specific subgenre is portal fiction, which are stories like Alice in Wonderland, Narnia, and John Carter of Mars.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah. So you're in a good neighborhood as far as that kind of stuff goes.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really good. And I have to say that as far as fantasy goes, not many fantasy stories grab me. You know, this one did. I have to say, your book grabbed me right from the start. And I love the fact that there was a lot of stuff going on. It was really interesting. And again, the female aspect of it really, I find, you know, engaging, because, like I said, it's something that I haven't experienced very much for me on that. But honestly, a lot of the characters in the book are female.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of exploring my friends and their women's friendships with other women's relationships with their sisters and their dads, and just kind of I was basing on things I was really seeing. I'm going to say also there's a thing where as you yourself meet more geek girls, I mean, it's a lot like with geek guys, where a lot of us are somewhere on the Asperger's spectrum. I definitely am. And kind of social norms aren't necessarily instinctive to us. We don't understand why everyone else is behaving a certain way and why something is cool and something else isn't cool. And one of those things is, especially when you're around 13 through 18 years old, being enthusiastic about stuff is uncool.
Yeah.
And May and her sister, Abby, and especially her best friend, Dahlia, are both all awkwardly enthusiastic about stuff.
I can relate to that. Because I, you know, I will talk to people who are not into comics or into stuff, and I try to describe to them what it is, and I get this puzzled look back. They don't get it. And, you know, I saw this book or this movie called Trekkies.
Oh, yeah.
And I recommended it to some people because there were people talking about this passion that they had. And a lot of people came out going, wow, I never understood that's what this is all about. It's like sports to you guys.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what we look at it as. This is when you do sports, and we call sportsing, some people do. it's to them, it's just like you're sportsing. This is our comicking. It's very much like that. So I like that.
There's the beauty of geekdom when it's a strong, good thing is that you leave room for other people to be geeks about other things.
Mm-hmm.
We're all outsiders to some extent. But you don't have to destroy someone else or hate someone else's thing to love your thing. I mean, you don't have to hate Star Wars to love Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. On the other hand, with sports, I live in Chicago, and you cannot – if you say you love both the Sox and the Cubs, yeah, you're the enemy of both sides.
That's funny. That's funny. Now, one of the things I want to talk with you about is how much I enjoy the dialogue in this book. The way when people speak, there's one on the seventh issue. I just want to, I won't reveal the situation, but there's a wonderful thing where Abby is being told she has to apologize to somebody. And her response is, I'm so sorry I kicked your ass, which was just wonderful. I laughed when I read it. I said, that's a wonderfully geeky way to respond to stuff, you know, and yet you're right. She's the adventure one. And so for her, that was very much of an action movie kind of response.
Yeah. Part of it is, okay, well, I mean, Abby is literally an action hero where, again, she can get punched by a troll and she's not dead. But the other thing is, she it was only very late in her youth where she actually found somebody else who understood her. And that was Captain Petra, who's now the bandit captain. The saving grace inside of May's life is that she found a best friend who understood her, and that allowed her not to always feel defensive about stuff.
Now, talk to me a little bit about the other characters, because there's some fantasy characters in there as well. There's like a, it's like a bug that stands above everybody else with two antennae, and he's got like a little something over his mouth and stuff like that. Talk about the, you know, coming up with other fantasy type characters like that. Was that fun for you to be able to develop these kinds of other, you know, humans? And I like reading human stuff, but I'm always engaged by alien type characters, so or fantasy type characters like the one you're doing. They serve a purpose in the story. How did you develop them?
Okay, I think the one you're talking about, the guy with the staff that blows up the ground. Hold on a second. I'm going to try to get the. I've got an official pronunciation both on my website and the back of the Lion Forge graphic novel.
Okay.
So, Ritter Kazisvet.
Okay.
Okay. That just means. Sir Kazisvet.
Okay.
And if you look very carefully at his design, you'll see that he's a man with robot arms, real arms underneath his cloak, and he's also on stilts.
Oh, really? But isn't he a bug? Isn't he an insect?
No, look carefully also. You'll see those glowing eyes on his helmet. There's eye holes underneath it.
Okay.
Real eyes are.
I may be looking at the wrong one, but the one I see is like a green a green bug head that's really tall, and he's got two antennae coming out. Is that the right one? Am I talking about the same one you are?
Oh, which issue are you talking about?
I'm talking issue 7.
Oh, issue 7. Oh, him. Actually, yes, he is a bug guy.
Okay. I was going, that doesn't look like a guy with a helmet. I couldn't get that.
Oh, no, he's a bug guy. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It's not the same guy, but there's someone of the same species on the cover of issue 3 also.
Okay, gotcha. Gotcha. So I talk about developing those kinds of characters. Do you make them to fill a function in the story, or do you because you like that kind of character? Have you always wanted to make one of those? Talk about developing the fantasy characters like that.
I guess there's obviously an inspiration from bits and pieces of Star Wars, and not directly stealing from the plot, mm-hmm. but just the society they built, especially in the first two movies, mm-hmm. where it just felt, when I saw those movies as kids, I saw them when they came out in theaters, mm-hmm. it inspired all this this world of possibility inside my mind. And actually kind of the disappointment in some of the later stuff is that by defining what everything is, now that there was an official, a semi-official definition of what a Botan is, or Bothan, and then a new official definition of what a Bothan is, which was completely contradicting by that, it's like, it's less interesting, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to build this world where you can dive into it and explore it and imagine it. In my head, this is my headcanon. It's not official until it hits print.
Okay.
So the big bug-headed guys, essentially it's a grasshopper face. Mm-hmm. They have a device covering up the mouth area, mm-hmm. Which allows them to speak in human words.
Okay.
Yeah, because otherwise they just make weird clicking noises.
Right. Well, that's good to know. Now, what about the steeds? Like, for example, there's like a horse-like thing that some people ride. What's that?
It's called a... official pronunciation. I have an actual professor of Slavic languages at the University of Chicago, Malin Sternstein, mm-hmm. Helping me out with Czech and made-up Czech names. Mm. So the creature is called Krakun.
Okay.
I'm doing that a little bit wrong. Krakunya.
Okay.
And it's a giant horse, rabbit, lion, gazelle steed.
Oh, wow.
And a little bit of kangaroo in there, too.
Oh, cool. That's cool, because I, you know, when it's one place in one of the comics, there's like clap, 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 clap when it's moving along. So I was kind of interested. One more I'm kind of interested in. In the issue 7 particularly, there's this little raccoonish, I don't know what it is, that, you know, May is standing there at one point and she's talking with him about the business of marriage and affairs of state and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. That's Kavito.
Okay.
Which is just the Czech spelling of Guido.
Okay.
let me see. He's and he's actually my cartoon bipedal version of a real United States animal that I'd never heard of until I started drawing the book, called a ringtail cat, which is lives in the American Southwest.
Oh, wow. Very cool. See, I like these kinds of things. They're educational on some levels, but they're also entertaining. I mean, you know, they've got very different characterizations for them when they do things, and I always get a huge kick out of those kinds of characters. I'm always interested in what function they serve in the story. So I really like all that good stuff. Now, of course, I've got to ask you, as an artist turned writer artist, talk to me about that transition. I mean, being able to write the story. Do you write the story first and then draw it? Do you draw it as you're going and the story comes into your head? How do you do that now? Because this must be a different function than just drawing. You know, somebody gives you a script and you go from there. Now that you're developing the story along the way and the characters and stuff like that, talk about that process, how different that may be for you.
For me, okay, so if I'm writing for myself and I know I'm going to draw it, I do it as little thumbnail sketches, like maybe about 1 inch by a 1/2 inch across. Hmm. And I just sketch in the action on each page, the panel breaks, and little tiny bits of the dialogue just indicate where the dialogue's going. Mm-hmm. But I don't start off with the script first, and then I later inside the next stage of roughs where I do it larger. Mm-hmm. I place the word balloons with full dialogue and everything. Mm. If I'm writing for somebody else, then I do the traditional full script with it looks like a movie script kind of, or you can any script you look at online is usually a full script for comics.
Right.
The last thing though is that I have had guest writers like Mark Wade and Molly Jane Kramer. Mm-hmm. And Danny Busiek, and then I just give them I give them the story beats that need to be in the story, like what needs to be accomplished, mm-hmm. and then they take that and they run it. As long as they hit those beats and those things get accomplished as set up for later story, mm-hmm. or to finish off beats from earlier stories, I don't really care what they do as long as it works.
Mm-hmm.
And like in the case of Mark Wade's upcoming story, issue number 8, mm-hmm. I gave him story beats for May's story and what happens to her next.
Mm-hmm.
And he realized, because he's effing Mark Waid. You know, it'd be so much more interesting to hit these story beats, but to tell it from, I gave him story beats for Abby, sorry. I gave him story beats for Abby, and he thought it through and was like, this would be so much more interesting taking these story beats and looking at it from May's point of view. And he did something he did several things I would never have imagined, or actually had promised myself, this will never happen inside of a May story. Like, I'd often said, there will never be a point where May takes off her glasses and then somebody says, oh my God, you're beautiful. And that actually does happen in the story. Because if you remember being a teenager, it's the same for girls. You meet somebody so cute, your brain shuts off for a little bit.
Very cool. I got to interview Mark Waid a long time ago, and I said to him one time, I couldn't figure how he could come up with these amazing, you know, plots. And then, you know, he would write the story and he would paint the heroes into this corner, and I couldn't figure how in the world he was going to resolve this. And I said to him, I said, you must have that figured out ahead of time. And he goes, well, no, actually. I sit down with my editor and we kind of figure out, we hash it out and figure out how we're going to do that. And he was so afraid that he had disappointed me, you know, that here I thought he was this genius guy coming up with all these amazing plot things. And I said, well, no, if that's the way you do it, you know, hey, you know, you're a writer. It's one of the best kinds of stories I like is when I cannot figure out how they're going to resolve this.
Oh, yeah.
And he would do it, and I would just be sitting there going, like, wow, how did that ever happen?
There's a thing, if you there's commentary tracks you can listen to for Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. Mm-hmm. And one thing that just blew my mind when I heard about it is that the writing teams on those shows do not figure out the solutions when they create the problems. And they'll constantly be writing themselves into corners, and then they have to figure out how they're going to write themselves out of it. And that's what Mark Waid says he's doing. And it's pretty much hearing from Houdini. So when you lock yourself inside of that, you know, in those chains, and you get dunked underwater, so you have a plan to how to get out of it. And it's like being told by Houdini, not actually, I just kind of have to make it up each time. It's a little more amazing.
Well, it's the way that he does things. And you know, you're right. He sees things from perspectives the rest of us don't. And that kind of makes his writing so much fun to read. Like that. So I'm glad he's going to get to do a story for you. And I'm glad he's kind of going where Gene Ha may not have gone before.
Oh, there's so many ways he's just like, I learned about what a genius he is. And someday, hopefully, I'll start to learn how he does it by practice. It's the only way to do it is practice.
Very cool. Well, it's, you know, the more you do it, I think the better it's getting when you do it. Like issue 7 to me really percolated really well. I mean, of course, there's a big surprise at the end, and I won't spoil that, but I want people to buy the book. It's just one of those great books that on so many levels, it fills those needs for variety, for understanding female geeks, for adventure, for fantasy kind of stuff. It's one of those great books that I really love, and so I'm just hoping this book continues on for a long time. I do want to ask one thing. You switched companies from Dark Horse to Lion Forge.
Yeah.
Which was interesting. Did that work out better for you as far as that goes?
Yeah. I mean, I love my Dark Horse team, my editors and stuff like that. Daniel Chabon and Chantel LaRocque. Mm-hmm. They just taught me so much. They guided me through so many things. But as companies go, Dark Horse is totally focused on comic shops. Mm. And I wanted, you know, I'm married to a librarian. I was taught to read comics by libraries more than by anything else. The South Bend Public Library, St. Joseph County Public Library, stocked French comic books like Asterix and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, wow.
And this just, expanded my world. So I wanted to reach out to these worlds, too, and Lion Forge is a better fit for doing that.
Okay. Well, that's cool. Because, you know, my understanding is they put that first trade paperback back out under Lion Forge, right?
Yes.
Because now if you want to, you just get Lion Forge, you can get the whole thing and continue on from here.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have an idea as how many issues you're going to do? I mean, you did the first six and then collected it. Now number 7 is out. Do you have are you going to do like a number to make a trade and then continue the story on?
Yeah. My plan right now, all of the next arc is completely written. Volume 2 is written out. And it's going to be 6 issues long. The 6th issue is I can't really remember if it's 2 or 4 pages extra longer, just because there's a lot of things that need to be tied up. Mm-hmm. I know Volume 3, the big action happens. It's almost like I've read a history book on what events happened in their lives after that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know the fine details. And after that, it's a bit like if you took some event from the American Civil War or something like that and said, gave it to 2 playwrights and said, now interpret, you know, the week of the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. And they're both going to come up with totally different things. I don't know what the characters are going to be doing specifically in response to the big events. I know vaguely what they're going to be doing, and I definitely know what the big events are. But every time so far, they've surprised me. And I've worked with three editors on this book, and they've each pushed the story further in ways I didn't expect and changed things and said, you know, this could be a little more interesting if you do this. And have you thought – I mean, I'm not going to quite claim that I need as much guidance as – I'm glad to say I didn't need as much guidance as Stuart Moore gave me that first time. But I still appreciate the guidance. They're good editors.
Well, you know, somebody else can add a perspective that you may not have considered yet.
Oh, yeah.
And that is such a help.
Yeah. Issue 9 is written by Molly Jane Kramer. She's a part of a comics journalist with Doom Rocket. She's also a comic shop clerk and incredibly knowledgeable. And she's just a huge comic geek who's friends with lots of other female and male comic geeks. And she taught me a lot about how, like, the friendship of geeks, female geeks, works in the specifics and what they deal with and how they deal with it. And that's why I was going to write that issue myself, and I kept on questioning Molly about, like, details of her own actual life. And at some point I just kind of said, you know, I'm just kind of transcribing what you're saying to a certain extent. Do you actually want to write this issue? And she said, okay. And then she did it. It's been wonderful.
Well, that's great. It's neat, too, that you're able to let other people play in your sandbox. Because some people can't do that, you know. David Peterson does, and I always enjoy that. And you're able to let people do that too, which I always think that kind of expands the universe a little bit in directions you may not have considered. You know, as great as your imagination is about this and the way that you've moved, there are still little places that you could go that you may not have considered yet, and these people can help you with that.
Oh yeah. I'm going to say that one of the things I did to learn about writing after I got through the Stuart Mill gauntlet, it was a useful gauntlet, but it was like running through a line of soldiers kicking you, is that I began watching DVDs of things like The Sopranos and things like that, and obviously Breaking Bad later, and listening to the commentary tracks and finding out how the writers worked. And so one of the ways I was taught was learning how writing rooms work, how teams of writers work together, and how they get assigned a script, and they get assigned, you know, you get the story beats, and then you're expected to figure out an amusing story that happens along the way inside these beats that we're not expecting. Your job is to surprise us. So when I do ask a guest writer to help out, every time I'm hoping they'll do something I would not do. I'm begging them to do stuff I wouldn't do.
Well, that's cool, because yeah, I got to tell you, not every writer would be open to that. Maybe because you're an artist writer, maybe that kind of gives you a little more freedom as far as that goes. Because I've known some writers that when somebody does something that's not in their, you know, in their bailiwick, they kind of go, oh, I don't like that. We got to take that out.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you don't do that.
Oh, no. Also say that I have met writers who don't write like Mark Waid does and who have everything plotted out. They know how when two characters meet, how they're going to interact with each other, the kind of things they'll say, how they'll solve every problem. And I'm going to say I find these writers a little boring after a while. I'm not going to name names, but it's more interesting when you have the writers who are ready to surprise themselves. I think you can go too far with this, but Alan Moore, and he put out a book on how he writes now and how he used to write when he first got the American industry. And I think this is a good principle in general. It's don't plan ahead more than you have to. So when Alan Moore is writing, say, a big giant time travel story, he's going to plot. He has to plot out everything because everything has to tie back together with the beginning and the end. But when he was working on Top 10 with me, he knew certain things were going to be significant later, like a piece of music playing or the symbol on Jeff Smacks's chest. He knew what it all meant. But he had not planned everything else out. And one issue, he just even like he was sick. He wrote two pages, and the second page was a giant cityscape seen from above. So there was no blue sky, empty space for me to not draw into. And he did that to slow me down so he'd have enough time to get well and then figure out what the rest of the issue was going to be. And it worked perfectly. He surprised himself.
Wow! How about that?
We won an Eisner for that issue.
See, when you were describing this whole business with the writing stuff, it's more organic. if you let things develop in front of you, because I can think of a certain screenwriter who used to had what he called the fabulous five-year arc, where this TV show was going to move along and it was never going to vary. But then reality got in the way.
Yeah.
And he had to make changes to it, which was, you know, it was funny to watch how he struggled to get things. He was so certain he had everything planned out exactly the way it was going to go. And I remember saying, you can't do that, especially not on television. You've got to have flexibility. And sure enough, one of the actors had to leave the show, and it blew everything right out of the water. So yeah. I'm glad that you do that, because it does have that feel of organic flow to it, and very natural. Because, you know, people don't do that. We don't sit around and talk about, you know, and have everything planned out for 5 years and stuff like that. We're going to sit there, and when we talk to each other, I'll tell you a really quick story, and I don't want to bore you with it. I was part of a group that was writing Star Trek. There was a group in the Washington, D.C. area that was making Star Trek fan films. And we had always talked about the fact that this one show had talked about there was going to be a telepath war. And, you know, when they actually performed, it didn't turn out all that well. And I said, you know, someday we should show them what that's like. And, man, we just, all of us just dove into it. And we were doing, figuring out all the telepathic races in Star Trek and figuring out how this would all work out together and stuff. You know, when you talk about that kind of organic thing, that experience to me taught me a lot about that. Don't, like you're saying, don't plan too far in advance.
Yeah. Part of my training is in high school, is I joined my high school's improv troupe. And all of that is about just being in the moment and just letting the creativity flow between people and out of yourself. And there's another simple reason why that Alan Moore theory works so well, which is that there's only so much creativity you can have in a day. And if you try to plan out a five-year arc based on like 1 month's or 1 week's creativity, that means you're tossing aside the next 5 years of creativity that you're going to put into that thing. Or you're just going to jam little bits of creativity into the corners. And you got to trust that you will be as creative and fun, you know, 5 years from now or 2 years from now as you are right now. And if you allow that extra creativity in, instead of having 1 month creativity inside your TV show or your comic book, you're going to have 5 years times 12 months, 60 times as much creativity inside that project.
Wow. I hope that artists and writers are taking notes, because I think this is really important stuff that you're saying about making, you know, being creative. You know, today I will be creative all day and tomorrow I will not, kind of stuff. I've heard people tell me that and I go like, what? How do you do that?
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's great the way that you do that, and that you can be flexible. And I think it makes the story a lot more lively and vibrant.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some writers out there who can plot out the whole thing in their heads and everything is brilliant and stuff like that in a way I can't imagine, in the same way that like George Perez, or I think it's Kim Jong-gi, the artist can like think of a whole cityscape and then draw it just from their heads. You know, these are singular individuals. Most of us, I think the rest of us, it's better to just keep on being creative at every moment and letting it flow out.
Super cool. Now, I should ask you, number 7 is out. Do you know when number 8 is going to come out? Is that going to be in the middle of July?
Oh, yeah, I think that should be on schedule. I don't want to give a date on this, but I'm going to be probably, might be a little, I think 9 should come out on time, but everything's getting very tight after that. I am a detail oriented guy. I cause problems for my editors.
Who's the editor, by the way, at Lion Forge for you?
Oh, at Lion Forge, it's Andrea Colvin. She's a former, I think it's Random House editor. But she definitely worked in comics before that, but more for the book market. And then she has Grace Bornhoft as her editorial assistant. And she is brilliant too, but she was pretty much fresh out of college when she began working for Andrea at a book publishing house in New York. And then when Andrea moved to Lion Forge, she respected and liked Grace's work so much, she headhunted her. And it's worth it. She's been great.
Oh, wow. I'm glad this works. The book reflects all this. It has a great feel of creativity and being alive. And the characters, to me, are like I know them. You know, I've come to understand and know them now. They're not just comic characters on a page. They are people that I've come to understand. It was like there was a show called Saint Elsewhere. And
I love that show.
I knew every person on that show. I felt like I knew them all. I had experienced life with them, you know, so many times. And when the show came to an end, I felt like I'd lost about 40 friends. You know, it was such a tremendous show. And that, and I get that feeling with your book, too. I get the sense that we're getting to know these characters, and I'm starting to understand them and beginning to enjoy. When Abby says that made me laugh, because you know that's so in her character. I love that whole business about you know, I'm sorry that I had to kick your ass kind of stuff. That just made me laugh. So that's good stuff.
I'll say in a future issue, there's a scene where May finally gets to like talk with her boyfriend again, and I had it all planned out in my head for months and months and months. Mm-hmm. And when I finally wrote it, and then I called in Molly Jane Kramer for some advice on it. Mm-hmm. And then that changed it. Mm-hmm. And then I actually let her write that scene. It's in a later issue. Mm-hmm. And then after she wrote it, I was like, oh man, I didn't even think through the beats I gave you. I think there might be a little off. And then we worked together and realized that each character would think differently than I had expected. Hmm. My characters constantly surprise me.
Hmm. Isn't that fun though?
Yeah. Oh, they're both smart and they both have the things that they're standing up for that are different than what I expected. It is amazing.
That's great fun. And of course, I'm so happy that we've got strong female characters and different ones too. I have friends of mine who think that a strong female character should be maternal. And I'm always like, I don't know. I said, all the guys aren't paternal. You know, a guy can be a scoundrel, a scientist, all these different things. Why do women all have to be motherly in that? And that's why I always, it's like your characters are, the two sisters are very different from each other. And I remember when I first read that, I loved that. I said, wow, two female characters that are very different from each other and still engaging. I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah. I wasn't sure about this when I began writing volume one, but Dahlia does get thrown into the mix more in volume two than I expected. Hmm. And she is very different. She ends up very differently than the two sisters too.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So I can't wait to see what this is going to be. Now I can't wait to see where you're going to go. Do you have like an end game in mind as far as May goes? I mean, do you just keep going until the story kind of tells itself, or do you have a number of issues in mind?
There's not a specific. The thing is, a trick I learned from, again, reading Alan Moore, mm-hmm. is when I was reading his run on Swamp Thing, I kept on thinking like, well, that's the end of that story. Where is he going to? How could he take it anywhere? You know, beyond that. Mm-hmm. And he kept on taking it beyond. And that taught me this whole kind of ladder, what I call a threat ladder. I don't think it's not a term he uses, where essentially every time you make something big, you can always find something bigger. It's that whole thing in the real world, as tough as you are, there's always someone who can beat you up. Mm-hmm. And there's always some threat that's either, you know, it could just be a guy who's bigger or tougher, or it could be a guy who's smarter and is not going to fight you on your own terms. Mm-hmm. But there's always going to be a problem you're not ready for. And that's just because that's what real life is like.
Mm-hmm. Now, I saw you at conventions. Do you have any other conventions that you're going to in the next, like up till the end of the year?
I will announce something because just like you can't, you know, no one takes coupon codes from podcasts, and therefore they can announce coupon codes. Mm-hmm. Nobody like posts them online. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to be at Wizard Chicago. Mm. On the 4th of July. Oh, okay. Let me just go in order. 4th of July week, July 4th to July 7th, I'm doing a whirlwind tour of Maryland. Mm. Doing some local library cons, mm-hmm. Wizard Chicago, Las Vegas Library Con, Vegas Valley Comic Book Festival. Mm. And then here's the big thing that's not announced yet, but I'm just going to say it because you're a podcast.
Okay.
I have been invited to Dutch Comic Con.
Oh, really? Wow, good for you. You get to go overseas.
Oh, yeah. I went to the Netherlands once when I was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming it's going to be much, much different now. And mm-hmm. also, I'll be able to wander on my own. So I'm expecting to have a very different adventure. But mostly stuff that's, you know, I'm actually almost completely stuff that's legal in the United States.
Wow. Well, that's super smooth. That's going to be fun because I always like it because I've been to some other countries. I'm hoping to get to Toronto this year. We'll see if I get there or not. But I always like when I get to go. Like I went to Mexico one summer, and that was a very different experience as far as life. And I think it's great to be able to understand it. When you come back to your own experience, you kind of look at it differently. You are more – You know, you see yourself in a different light, yeah. Which I like.
I got to visit, well, Tijuana back when I was, before 2001, I visited there, which was weird. kind of fun, but weird. And then I got to visit Mexico City not that long ago. Mm-hmm. And they are amazingly wonderful, generous people, the huggiest, most passionate comic fans I've ever met in my life. The thing that really surprised me, though, is it gave me the feel as if I almost like I was in ancient Rome.
Really?
Where, like, you have these citizens kind of trying to thrive in this very corrupt, very messed up government system. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, they have so much wonderful stuff and a government that does not care about them. Mm. It's just, you know.
Mm, it's too bad.
Yeah, but the people are wonderful.
Mm-hmm. One thing I remember about Mexico was that I went to this the Church of Mary. And there were people that they would do is they would buy little, like little pins that would have like a leg on it if they had leg troubles, and they would, they would kneel and go, you know, step by step on their knees to get to the church, to kind of, you know, show their devotion and things like that.
Yeah.
And I always kind of was like, I don't understand that. You know, you might be better to go to a hospital, but nothing against the church. You know, I consider myself something of a spiritual person, but I just found that kind of difficult. You know, I thought, you know, there are hospitals for good reasons and stuff like that. So I was very surprised about that. But you're right about Huggy. I was on a bus, and all these guys, you know, in America, you'd never see it because we can't do that stuff. But on there's all these guys sitting around with their arms draped around each other. And I was kind of looking at it going like, wow, we'd never do that up in America.
Oh,
we couldn't do that for anything. But I got a big kick out of that. It, again, when you see something that you're not used to, it kind of expands your mind a little bit, which I like.
Yeah.
Now, do you have any other projects you're working on? Is May keeping you busy, pretty much?
It's all I'm really doing right now at all. After I get done, I'm probably going to take a break from May, in form of sketches and roughs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The next arc in detail with the tight dialogue and probably a few other projects, but I want to focus on things that are also YA, mm-hmm. Young adult, teen focused. So, you know, there's a lot of possibilities out there. I mean, maybe I'll do my first Archie story. DC has their new Zoom line. So.
Right, right. Good for you, man. I'd love to see it because I think that the more you do this stuff, the better it gets. I think you're growing and growing as a storyteller, not just an artist and not just a writer, but it's just getting to be great fun to read your stuff. And I highly recommend, if you haven't gotten the first trade of the first six issues, I highly recommend you get that and then get on into the first issue of the second set. And I would recommend get your store to order it for you on a regular basis, because that way you know when it's in, you've got it. And that's the way I am. I can't wait. I've got this one, and now I can't wait for the next one. So it's always good to have that stuff. And Gene, you're doing a wonderful job. I really, really love the stuff that you do. And May is just a perfect example of what I think is the height of art and writing going together really well. So I think you're doing wonderful.
Thanks so much. I should also mention, I'm just going to do a little shout out to comic shops here, that even if you're not a comic shop that focuses on books for teens and younger and stuff like that, it's good to stock a book like May or some Raina Telgemeier. So that way when your regular comes in and drags his kid along who's not into comics yet, you have something to throw at him.
Very good. Very good. Well, I hope people take your advice because it sounds like good stuff. And I'm just curious to see how many women actually read May, because I think that they might enjoy it just as much as I do as a guy.
Oh, yeah. I have. I just went to ALA recently. Mm-hmm. And just like the stereotype, most librarians are women. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are really, really enjoying May. And also a lot of kids who are boys are really enjoying May too. So
good. See, I think that's a good thing. I think that's going to help us as a culture to continue to grow and move forward when that's kind of stuff. I think May is a very important part of that. So again, I say, if you haven't been getting May yet, MAE, get to your comic store, make sure that they order it for you, get that trade, and then get in on the monthly book. I think you're going to enjoy it. So, you know, Gene, keep it up. It's great.
It's been great fun talking to you.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
that's a wrap for this episode. Until next time, keep reading your comics.